But it starts with Matt Damon meeting his wife, and he's scared to go and say hello. And he says, you know what? 20 seconds of courage, 20 seconds of bravery. Just, you can do anything for 20 seconds. Just be brave for 20 seconds and then see what opportunities come on the back of it. Now, he was uncertain when he went into that. And it's based on a true story, right? So when he went into that cafe and asked his wife for her number, or, you know, whatever it was he said, or made that introduction, he didn't know at that point he was going to become his wife, but he was uncertain that she could have just said, I'm married, or no, I'm not interested, or whatever. So if you are feeling uncertain, when you get going, when you get into that flow, whether it's getting up on stage, doing that public talk, doing that thing that you're unsure about, after about 20 seconds, you'll find a lot of that initial anxiety is gone. You'll be in a different state than you were 20 seconds ago, whatever that state is. Hopefully it's somewhere better. But the position, the state of mind, everything that you, the whole way you saw the world before that moment of stress, that moment of uncertainty, 20 seconds later will look entirely different. Good. But today we're going to be talking about something slightly different, I believe. We're going to be talking about uncertainty. And I think that's a bit much a follow-on from the previous episodes, right? The uncertainty of what happens next in your situation, having the sudden loss of your father, the uncertainty of mine of not knowing when that date might come for my father, but also just how, you know, the idea of uncertainty and how it can impact our lives, how how that leaks into a lack of confidence sometimes. And I think from a mindset perspective, how both of us view uncertainty in slightly different ways as potentially as an element of strength. And I think it's an interesting place to explore as a concept. What are your feelings? And maybe you can take the floor with your view.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with uncertainty is it is ever present, right? For example, even a very real example, right? You and I last week, right? We were trying to do this call and I was in Brighton, tethered off my phone, and it didn't kind of work. And so nothing in life is certain, except for obviously death and taxes, as the old saying goes. But effectively, because we have to live with uncertainty throughout our lives, it's how do we deal with that? And the reality is you cannot control the events in your life, right? We've talked about this many times. But what you can control is your response to those events. So I guess it's understanding where is the certainty within uncertainty, because I think we started to talk about it last week, and I'm not sure if you looked up this stuff in the week in the interim, but Tony Robbins, the motivational guru, whatever, he has his six human needs, right? So you've got like Maslow's hierarchy of needs that people may be familiar with, but Tony Robbins talks about these six human needs, and the first two are foundational needs, right? The other two are additional needs. The extra two are growth, I think, and contribution. But the other ones are love and connection, or love slash connection, significance. But then the two base needs are certainty, because we want a certainty in our life, but uncertainty as well, variety. And because, for example, if you've ever watched a movie that you've already watched, you know, why is it we do that? Well, we're kind of certain that we're going to enjoy it if we enjoyed it, or we're going to get a certain response, right? Laughter, tears, you know, connection with the person we're watching it with. But at the same time, we want a little bit of uncertainty, because there's going to be a different emotional response we might get. We also want uncertainty by watching new movies, right? But there may be the same kind of movies. For example, you're always watching Marvel movies, right? Because you're certain you're going to have a good time, you're into superheroes as well. But you don't know exactly what's going to happen in the movie. So we've got this dichotomy in our lives, the need for certainty and yet the need for uncertainty. And sometimes we feel like we go away from the uncertainty because we want things certain. But if we knew everything, if we knew every day what was going to happen when we left that house, and that this is actually the problem for lots of people, it gets quite boring, right? You know, you're going to get that 7:06 train. You're going to spend 23 minutes on the train. You're going to walk, get your Starbucks. You're going to go into the office. Your boss isn't going to say hello to you. You're going to sit down. And when you've got that certainty of your pattern, it becomes boring and depressing, actually. So this is weird. We've got this thing. We need just both certainty and uncertainty.
Yeah, well, I think we've tackled some of these elements in slightly different ways in previous episodes, right? I mean, I've talked a lot about in the past about the idea of being flown to the top of Everest versus climbing to the top of Everest. And the thing that makes the, you know, you're looking at the same vista, but the view is entirely different because that the person that's been through that journey and actually faced all of that uncertainty, that question of, will I make it to the top? The question of, will I have got enough oxygen? Will I get out of the death zone? All those things that come in, that's what makes that vista at the top of that view so spectacular, right? Because you've gone through that uncertainty. And actually it's when you go through uncertainty, we can often find the real beauty in things. And it's not a surprise when you see people that have got access to everything. If you think about it in terms of financial terms, the billionaires of this world or the multimillionaires of this world often aren't happy. They're not fulfilled because, you know, if they want a Lamborghini or a Ferrari, they can just, you know, they can buy plenty for. They want to go somewhere, they can do it. There is little uncertainty in their lives, and it gets depressing because sometimes there's value and excitement in uncertainty. It's not knowing the outcome. The idea of getting on stage for many people would be very, you know, would bring up feelings of real anxiety, of real fear, because they're uncertain on how it's going to go. And yet 9 times out of 10, certainly in my experience, whether it's a theatre performance, which is obviously my background, or whether it's giving a speech or whatever, after the fact, when you've delivered the speech, you've done that thing, you've delivered the performance, that's where the euphoria comes in. You've got through the uncertainty, you've worked through that journey, and it's like, wow, A, I got through it, B, I can do it. And actually, I look at the reception that we got. And that's why I think sometimes, you know, uncertainty can have a negative connotation attached to it. But actually, one thing, as you mentioned earlier, that we all know is an absolute guaranteed constant, and that's change. Change is always around us. So if we can embrace the change rather than be fearful of it, I think that's a really positive outcome. I know one thing that you and I have talked about a few times, which is Stoic philosophy. So control what you can, cope with what you can't, control what you can, cope with what you can't, and concentrate on what's important. And the way that you remember that is with the C's that it links to. But actually, there's 3 C's in uncertainty as well, and there's context, which is the awareness of the threat level, the awareness of the person laughing at us or heckling us on stage or whatever that might be, that gives us that feeling inside of that real anxiety, the emotional reaction. Then you've got the content side. So the meaning making behind that level of anxiety, the assumptions we're making, do the people have the same values as me? Does this align with my purpose? And then there's the conduct side. So 3 C's, context, content, and conduct. And the conduct side is the acceptance of that committed action. You know, the ability to problem solve it, the ability to label it and access the mindfulness techniques, which, you know, you're so skilled at telling us all about, Harry, that I think if you can get those 3 things together, for many people that are listening to this, that have something in their lives right now they might be uncertain about, we can flip that on its head and say, you know what, this is an opportunity. Uncertainty brings opportunity every single time. And I know that you've got some practical applications about how we can help ourselves deal with that anxiety that comes with it.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about context as well, because when you were talking earlier about uncertainty, what jumps into my head is a specific situation where there is somewhat uncertainty, but where I really enjoy it. And this is airports. I really love like airports, and I don't love them enough that I'd want to work there or spend a huge amount. But when you know, a lot of people, they want to get to the destination as quickly as possible when they start their holiday. Then my holiday always starts the moment I step out the front door. But what I love about airports is this idea of possibility, is this idea that you're going somewhere and you don't know what it might bring and or who you might bump into or whatever else. And inevitably, you know, they're not particularly interesting, the airports, a lot of the time. It's rare that I would have anything massive to shout about. But it's that feeling that when I go, because I'm going into a world of possibilities. Airports, even though you might have your ticket to a certain destination, it just feels to me that the world is at your fingertips there. And I remember when I was traveling, so as you know, and maybe the listeners know, but I traveled for about 2 and a bit years after university, from 1999 to the end of 2001. And I remember what was uncertain all the time was where I was going to stay, right? Because for the first year that I was traveling, I never spent more than 4 nights in any one location. And then I went and lived in Sydney for about 4 months. And I remember after spending 4 months in Sydney, getting on that bus for the first time, and I felt really quite anxious because I was getting a bus down to Melbourne and I was going to move there for 2 months, because I got used to that certainty of I had this flat, 3 flatmates, and I was by the Coogee Beach so I could go for a swim after work. And so I had that certainty there. And then as soon as this weird uncertainty came, I got anxious and nervous. And I had to remind myself that I was always able to do that before. Right? I was moving every 4 days or something. And so I guess my thing with uncertainty, where I talk to clients, because uncertainty is everywhere, right? You can't escape it. But where can you be certain within that uncertainty? And the place where I think that most people can be certain within that uncertainty is in their response. So what I mean by that is, like for example, I'm uncertain about various things that are happening in my life, right? Not just my father's death, but some domestic issues and changes and all that. But what I can be certain of is that I'll find a way, or that I have done things in the past, right? I draw on past experiences of where I've overcome challenges. And I was certain I got through that, because I did get through it, because it's in the past. And so that brings me certainty. So I always say to people, find certainty in like your response, right? You're certain that you're going to adapt. You're certain that you're going to be flexible. You're certain that you're going to survive this in some way, shape or form. Might not be the way you want, but you've still got certainty. You can't control the events because that's going to be uncertain, but you're certain in your response. That would be my main go-to, if I'm honest.
I think building on, I've got something to think about here, and this has certainly happened in my life. I'm sure it's happened to most listeners as well. And I'll get to the point I'm going to make in just a moment, but to build upon your airport moment, it reminded me of when I went to Vegas with two of my friends, and I decided that I wanted to do a skydive. Now, of course, that's for me, as someone who's relatively fearful of heights anyway, that is absolutely like peppered with uncertainty, and the uncertainty, of course, links to then the context, the fear that if the parachute doesn't open, I'm dead. That's the biggest fear. That's what creates that anxiety. But also that's the reason I want to do it as well. Not because I want to die, but because I want to feel the rush of that level of uncertainty is what gives you the high. Knowing this could happen is what gives you the high that it hasn't, and you've come through it, and you've essentially given yourself a catalyst for growth in one way or another, because you've confronted your fear and you've been able to overcome it. And there's certain things you can think about there. You might lean on breathing, for example, and I was certainly taking deep breaths before I went in and trying to calm myself because I was incredibly nervous. The danger, of course, then where the brain kicks in and where we can get ourselves in trouble is knowing, as you've mentioned there, and the point I wanted to raise now is knowing where we're certain, I think, is great. I couldn't agree more with the advice you've given. But for people listening to this that are going through uncertainty, what we tend to do is our brain now takes over and takes us to a place of probably 10, 20 times worse than what's actually going to happen. We create these stories in our minds of saying, if I do this, then this could happen, then this could happen. It's a bit like I work in the world of recruitment and someone gets made redundant. And I obviously coach a lot of clients, particularly in relation to career coaching. And their biggest fear is, and that means, if I don't find a job soon, I'm going to be unable to pay my bills. I'm going to end up losing my house. Then I'll end up homeless. Then my kids have nowhere to go to school. I won't be able to feed. And they've gone to the nth degree because it's the what next, what next, what next. And that's where the uncertainty can build real fear and paranoia and anxiety beyond belief. And even if you find your certainties within there, that's the thing I think that sometimes can be quite difficult for people to manage.
It's interesting that you use that as an example you talked about Stoic philosophy before, but one of the ways that they deal with it, and I think you might have mentioned it before, I certainly mentioned it to a friend of mine about 6-7 weeks ago, but it is actually to play out, or you've mentioned it before as catastrophizing, but like to play out that worst case scenario, because often it will never get as bad as the way you catastrophize. But then when you get to that point, you go, okay, so then what's going to happen? Because I've often thought about this. If I do this and I do this, then what will happen? I go, all right, well, I'm going to have to, whatever, join the army just so I have a roof over my head. Now, I wouldn't really want to do that. But I think this actually is something I was doing, unfortunately, with my dad, right? And I've been doing this for about 3 or 4 years, maybe longer, because I remember reading about this in, I think it's A Guide to the Good Life, which is a really good book on Stoic philosophy that I do recommend. And so I started playing this out, right? How would I be? And it's really hard because you're basically doing negative visualization, because you close your eyes, at least I close my eyes, I get into it. And it used to bring me to tears, because I would vividly imagine that point. And in a way, I did the grieving progressively over the last 5 years before the event has happened itself. And so that kind of sort of helped. And I think if you do play out the worst case scenario and say, okay, well, what's going to happen if I lose my job? And what's going to happen if this happens and this happens and this happens? And then you might get to the point where actually, all right, I can cope with that, right? Okay, I'm going to have to live on my sister's couch. I'm going to, you know, my kids are going to have to like share a bedroom or something as we downsize from a four bedroom to a one bedroom or something. Not great, but, and probably unlikely to happen as well in the grand scheme of things, but you get to that, the worst case scenario. I think it's actually a coping mechanism, coping tool.
I fully agree. I mean, I've talked about the power of catastrophizing in a coaching context before in previous episodes, right? You catastrophize, you say the worst case scenario, and then you work back and go, actually, well, if that was to happen, I could take this action. If that was to happen, I'd be able to cope in this way using the Stoic philosophy and so on. I think interestingly though, it sounds so obvious when we're talking about it now. When we get to the worst point and you're finding yourself, imagining yourself in the fetal position, walking up and down in the room, right? Whatever it is that worst case scenario looks like to you, we often don't have that, just that extra thought, the most important one of all that you've just highlighted there is, okay, so if I do get to that point, what next? What do I do? How can I plan for it? Instead, we stay in that world of just pain or embarrassment. If you think about going back to the talking on stage, for example, a lot of people are fearful, and you know, you've done your Toastmasters courses, you've done a lot of you've done stand-up comedy, which must be a great example to talk about. Probably, I'm sure there's some anxiety and some uncertainty approaching that. People are going to laugh. Am I going to get heckled? All those things. But a lot of people that think about public speaking as an example, they'll go to the worst case in their eyes, which might be that everyone laughs at me and it's really embarrassing. But what they don't then ask themselves is, and if they were to do that, what would that mean for me? What would be the actual ramifications of that action? Would it be, it'd be forgotten about in a few minutes? It'd be this. And actually, it's very rarely as bad as we think it would be. But what is it we can do as a tool or to advise our listeners that when they get to that point of fear, I think that's where most people get stuck. They don't actually have that level of layering, I guess, to go, actually, okay, that is the worst case. They need to go that level further to go, and if that was to happen, actually, this is what I'd do. And you can almost create an action plan for it so that you feel more prepared. Of course, that's a worst case scenario, but just knowing you've got an action plan, we know if we've got plans for things, we tend to be less anxious about it. I'd be interested to know how you got on with your stand-up comedy. That was something you did. I never saw it. I'd like to.
Yeah, to be fair, there's actually some versions on video on YouTube, on my YouTube channel somewhere. But it's interesting because I was, as you were mentioning or reminding me of my stand-up comedy course, I was thinking actually we did do quite a level of certainty within that. And what I mean by that is that it was before we did the showcase. So it was a 9-week course and you do 8 sessions before you get to the showcase. And then you do a 1 session after the showcase to kind of see the feedback. But by the time you get to the showcase, you do have a certain level of certainty, because what happens is the first few weeks are, it's quite personal development-y actually, because you have to write down a lot about you and your fears and your quirks and this and the other to get material. But you're practicing that material in front of the other 10 or 15 people on your course. So you get an idea of what's going to work and what's not going to work by the time you actually get to that showcase. So you've got obviously uncertainty because it's a new crowd, new dynamics, you're on stage, it's all that. But you also have a certain level of certainty because you know that of the 100 or so jokes or bits you put in there, you've only kept 7 or 8 because you've whittled out the other 90 odd because you've done that. So you have a level of certainty which actually gives you comfort. And I think that plays into a lot of the things that you were mentioning about. I remember when I used to work in the London Stock Exchange and also when I used to work for Sainsbury's head office, and we would do these massive IT upgrades and cutovers and things like that. And one of the things, so you'd have to take the systems out for like a few hours and then make sure it's up. But one of the things I was always adamant on doing is always making the decisions ahead of time. So you play through all the different scenarios in those weeks of planning meetings so that when you get to the point and you say, right, it's not done by 11 o'clock on the dot, you don't need to wait till 11:01 or 11:02 to kind of see if it works. You've already made the decision that is your cutoff and that is it. So there's no decision to be made in that time. And I think, you know, whatever it is, what's the phrase, right? Proper planning prevents poor performance, whatever. Yeah, all of that. I think that's the level where we can get to, because you're certain in your robustness of planning but you're uncertain as to how the events will unfold.
It's a bit like having the fear might be you get heckled. But of course, if you're training over 8 sessions, I'm sure you planned for the hecklers. So you had somewhere to go.
Firstly, on these 5-minute showcases, no one's really ever going to heckle. But let's say that's the case, because I regularly stand up in front of challenging audiences, right? Teenagers. And sometimes, for example, and this is a weird example, but I go to schools, right? Different schools sometimes. And I might be at break and I've gone to the toilet and I've washed my hands, right? And sometimes these schools, the power of the way that the tap is, right? You're not familiar with the tap, right? And it powers off and literally it will spray and it will just soak you in the area that looks like you basically wet yourself, right? And then I've got like reasonably light colored trousers a lot of the time. So then I'm thinking, when that happens, or if that happens, how am I and I have to then stand in front of 30 people, how am I going to cope with like a stupid 15-year-old child or young adult who's kind of going to heckle me on that? So I have to think quick on my feet with those things, because often you get those kind of comments where, you know, you have to think. Again, it comes back to being certain that you're able to cope with whatever is thrown at you, because you're not going to ever know what's going to be thrown at you. And I think that comes from practice.
There are loads and loads of examples as well, I think, there are loads. I mean, I probably can't list any off the top of my head, but I know from just reading, and I'm sure you probably can, right? But where actually it's the, I can do it from a coaching context, actually, as a client I've been coaching recently who did lose a position through redundancy. And I remember the uncertainty attached, because they're breadwinner of the family, you know, lots of anxiety attached to that, a lot of, serious consideration going into how we plan for the next move. And this individual was offered a job and immediately wanted to take it. And we obviously worked together. And I said, it doesn't really align with your values, your purpose. It's not really in line with your moral compass, various things here, this particular position. You're taking it because you're fearful of the uncertainty that's attached around not having a job. But if it's so misaligned, it's not going to work for you. This will create more problems in the longer term. Now, you've got to make your own decisions and where you decide to go, but we're having a good session here. But let's go back to basics and understand what it is that you're uncertain about and then work through it. Anyway, without giving the whole coaching 6-month sort of process away in a couple of minutes, it turned out they did decline the opportunity. And by waiting and taking a patient approach and planning, they ended up with a position right on their doorstep at a level that is above anything they've ever worked at before, at C-suite level. And, you know, had they jumped in straight away, it never would have happened. But I use that as an example, because often it's in times of uncertainty that we have our biggest shifts in what happens. You know, people become authors, people change, make complete career pivots. Look at what the pandemic did for career pivoting. And you look back and go, you know what, if it wasn't for that issue, that event, that thing that happened, that thing I was unsure about, I may never be where I am now. And I think sometimes it's the uncertainty in our lives that gives us those defining moments that actually help propel us to whatever that you know, place is we really want to get to. So I think if we're able to shift our perspective to see uncertainty not as a barrier, but actually this is a potential opportunity for growth, this could lead to unexpected possibilities, I think that's great. I think in your example with the watermark on your trousers and a 15-year-old making comments, that would definitely be me as a 15-year-old, by the way. So I know they do that. I'll have been that kid. I think a lot of it as well is we've got to be aware of our own ego and the role our ego plays in uncertainty. So often our ego gets in the way. Now, the ego I would sum up as the version of ourselves we want to portray, that we want others to see. But it can often hold us back from who we really are anyway. It can hold us back from who we are authentically are and all those things. Now, I'm not saying we on your trousers makes you authentic or inauthentic. Laughing aside. The point being, often when it comes to uncertainty, when we're getting on stage, we're worried about embarrassing ourselves, worried about not being as good as we think we might be. And sometimes I think that's where ego can get in the way. If we let all that go, as you say, and go back to that catastrophizing, why does it matter? This too shall pass. This is part of, you know, the idea of, you know, Michael Jordan missing more hoops than anybody else, but then he sunk more. You know, every time I'll fail, as you put, the first attempt in learning, every time we make an error and we let the uncertainty in, let's say it does go bad. Okay, that's going to happen. We can't always assume it comes out to a good outcome initially. But we learn from it and we grow from it. And actually from failing, from something going wrong, next time you go to the children's locker room at the next school thing, you're going to make sure that you probably don't get any splashback.
A couple of things with that, right, is that you Like, firstly, I'm glad you said the word growth when it comes to uncertainty, because uncertainty leads to growth. And I want to talk about growth and how that links into things like comfort zone in a second. But the other thing is, though those opportunities, let's say, the way I look at it, let's say you're in front of students and then, you know, there's a comment because whatever, your shirt isn't tucked in properly, or I don't know, whatever the thing is. I always see that as an opportunity to grow, because it's about learning to think on my feet. So I always think that, and this is actually one of the main reasons that I started doing work in schools, because I thought probably the toughest audience you'll get will be teenagers a lot of the time. And so it gives me the ability so that when I'm in front of adults, I know that I can pretty much handle most of what I'm going to get. And so for me, it is that opportunity to grow. And I frame it like that. And I think it, like everything, right? Nothing has any meaning except for the meaning you give it. So I choose the meaning of that situation to be, this is an opportunity for me to grow, right? What do I need to learn from that? And this is where we talk about comfort zones, because there is certainty in your comfort zone, right? Always ordering the same food, always going to the same, and we do this all the time. I did this the other day. I've got my favorite takeaway, right? Where I always order my takeaways. And then the other day, I chose a different place because my one was closed on a Monday or whenever it was. And I was a bit apprehensive about that, because I was like, I'm not certain if I spend this 10, 15, 20 pounds, it's actually gonna be what I want. But then I went into certainty mode, and I thought, well, you know what? I'm certain I'm going to eat it anyway, or I'm certain that if it's so bad, I'm never going to order there again. So either way, I'm going to win in some way, right? Because I've picked off something. And so I think it's that frame, because when you get too stuck in your comfort zone, right? Same food, same people, same movies, same everything. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that, I say to people, right? Nothing wrong or right. You choose it. But most growth and most great stuff in life happens outside of one's comfort zone. And so there is uncertainty outside of the comfort zone. There is clearly uncertainty outside of the comfort zone, because you're not used to being there. But that's the only place where we grow. And this is why we have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. We have to be comfortable with being uncertain, because that's where growth comes. Otherwise, if all we wanted to do was be certain, I joke with students, at one point, crawling was part of their comfort zone and walking was not. But they had to push themselves outside of that zone because they saw other people doing it to get there. If we all wanted to stay in our comfort zone, we'd all be on our hands and knees crawling right now. But we're not. But somewhere between the age of 2 and 3, and whatever age the person listening right now is, we might think that it's okay to just stay in our comfort zone. And for some people, it might be, if you want limited options and limited opportunities. And that's fine. I'm not here to say that's right or wrong. It's just that a majority of people tend not to want that.
I mean, I'm sure it's a whole podcast in itself, and I'm sure it's on our list of covering anyway, which is all about happiness, right? I would argue that if you're always stuck in your comfort zone, are you really hitting your heights of happiness? Because we're not challenging ourselves and we're not pushing ourselves into those uncomfortable zones you talk about that allow us to grow. And I think if we're not growing, then we're stagnating. And I personally, maybe I'll get people disagreeing with me on this. I feel like if you're stagnating, you can't be that happy. Even if you might be getting by, but it's difficult to getting by in a comfort zone in that context. I think it's difficult to be truly happy if you're just in your comfort zone all of the time. You know, we want to be stressed. There's people talk about distress a lot. I think I talked about this one of the first episodes we recorded. You know, distress is the word we often hear, but it's on a curve. Distress is when we go too far on the stress curve. There's a place before that called eustress. And eustress is where we really thrive. It's where we get the right balance between challenge and it, you know, it gets all the cognitive neurons firing, because we feel like, you know, I'm in my zone. Yes, we're working hard, we're doing whatever we are. But I mean, you know, people have that state of flow, that state of zone. And that's before you get into the space of distress, in a place of eustress. If you're in your comfort zone and you don't ever hit that height, and I would argue that, yeah, you might be getting by, but are you really in that, you know, as happy as you could be? It's for another show, but I think we could, you know, definitely revisit that. What I thought was really interesting, though, how what you were talking about there brought to mind, and it's a book we quote probably more than any other, which is Man's Search for Meaning. And in there it says, I don't know if it was, I don't think it's Nietzsche's quote, but he's quoted it rather than Frankl's, but it says, he who has a why to live by can bear almost any how. Now, for me, that's something that underscores the power of purpose and values, but in uncertain times, certainly in the context of that book, which is in relation to being in a concentration camp, right? So in uncertain times, we can live with anything if we understand what our purpose is. It doesn't matter. If we've got our purpose, we understand our why, we can move forward. So I think if you go back to the example of even being a stand-up comedian, if that's something you really want to do inside and it's part of who you believe you want to be and it's speaking to you to do that, if everyone laughs for the wrong reasons or if you get heckled or it bombs, it doesn't really matter. That's one audience. It gives you a chance to go back, replan, go again, if that's important to you. I think the worst you could do is not get up in the first place because you'll never know. And if that's really what you want to do, that will make you unhappy. And I would argue unhappier than it would be even going on and bombing. I think we talk a lot on this show about mindfulness. And I think that actually when we're in that place of uncertainty, particularly in relation to getting up in front of crowds, I'll use a different word, which is mindlessness. It's kind of our automated response to uncertainty. We kind of go, I don't know what to do, and become completely mindless to everything. And that's a really good time to bring it back to going, okay, what is it that's bothering me? What is it that really matters? What's going to happen next? How can I plan for it? And just use some of the mindfulness exercises that you've given in abundance during the course of the previous episodes to take you out of that mindlessness state, that panic, and then breathe and do all the things to go, you know what? What's the worst that can happen? And plan for it. Take yourself there. And then grow from the experience. I couldn't agree more that growth is the key.
Yeah, I think with planning, when you talk about planning, this is also a practical suggestion I would make to people. Before I make the suggestion, I'll just kind of draw our minds back to like 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, whenever it was, when COVID first hit, right? Lots of uncertainty happening there, right? With jobs, health, all of that. I felt reasonably certain in some ways, right? Because early on, I kind of started to figure out what it was all about. And I'm pretty certain in my own, I guess, ability to be reasonably resilient with things. Now, that's not to say I didn't have concerns and wasn't thinking about things. But when it came to uncertainty within COVID, not just the illness itself, but specifically with work, right, with pay, a lot of people were uncertain about their pay. And I was thinking to myself, I've been like that for about 10 years because when I left the London Stock Exchange, my pay is very variable, right? You may get some months where you get some money, then you might go months without. And same with my sister. She's a director. I don't think she's worked for like a year and a half now. And you never know when the next paycheck is going to come. And so where this leads into my practical example for people is that when those uncertain times hit, like during COVID and everything else, because I'd already had some level of uncertainty over, say, paychecks for 10 years, I had that background resilience built in. So my suggestion on a practical perspective is to build in uncertainty into your day, into your life. And that means in a small way. For example, go and order a different cup of coffee, right, than you would normally order. Watch a different kind of movie. Go a different route to work. Do those small things where there is a level of uncertainty. You don't know if you're going to get stuck in traffic. You don't know if it's going to taste horrible. You don't know if the movie's going to suck. That's uncertainty and it's uncomfortable, but it's only a small level of uncomfort. And so therefore, when the bigger uncertainty things come in, you've got a bit of, you know, it's like, again, gym analogy, right? Going to the gym and trying to bench press 100 kilos when you've never bench pressed in your life. No, start with 5 kilos. And then you build up to 100 kilos. Same with uncertainty, because we know uncertainty is going to come and the big uncertainty is definitely going to come. Don't just have that 100 kilos land on your lap and have to move it. Start ahead of time with the 5 kilo weights.
There's a few things you mentioned with the pandemic that brings to mind. Obviously, a very sensitive subject for some who would have dealt with huge amounts of uncertainty, whether it's about your job, about a family member, whatever. And the Stoic philosophy comes back there, you know, control what you can. So if you want to wear a mask, that's what you need to do. Get the vaccine if you believe in it. Whatever it is, there's things you can control within that process. Cope with what you can't and concentrate on what's important, which might just be spending time with your family or earnings, whatever it is you need to do. What I thought was quite interesting, though, is everything you've just discussed there is doing, which we've talked about in pretty much every episode, is thing when we do things, try and do them with awareness. So a mindful response to uncertainty then, even if you are taking a different route to work in your example, because we're mindfully aware that we're taking that choice, it kind of takes some of the uncertainty out anyway, because we're doing it with consideration. We're doing it with planning. We're doing it because it aligns with our potentially our core values. It's in complete contrast to an automatic mindlessness response that might be there. That's often emotionally driven as a reaction, which is where uncertainty then brings all those other feelings of anxiety in. And yeah, I agree. You know, those kind of exposures to those smaller things can be really, really helpful in that context. And I think even in the pandemic, for many, of course, it was a devastating time for many, many reasons. But there were certainly some people that found opportunity in the pandemic as well and came out stronger, either as a family unit or they found a commercial opportunity or whatever it might be. So, you know, there are things there. What we can't avoid is uncertainty. We can't always avoid our reactions to it, but we can focus on trying to identify where unexpected opportunities might emerge, where we may be able to grow from the experience. I think probably we both agree that if we try and fight uncertainty or try and fight our reactions, then it becomes counterproductive. And that's where it really starts to build. It drives us towards burnout. And I think, you know, we saw that certainly during the pandemic. People were being driven to burnout because they were so floundering and working so hard, trying to overcome the uncertainty to a certain degree and didn't really take the time to reflect or get their awareness working. They were, as I say, they were going in that automatic, emotionally driven response as opposed to that pragmatic, calm, let's take a moment, let's catastrophize if we need to, let's plan for it, let's take a strategic approach to how we can try and improve our situation. It's when we reappraise our actions and sort of access all the different data points that we've got going on and whatever that problem is, that we can start to realize it could be an opportunity, and perhaps the uncertainty isn't an enemy. It's something that we can grow from, particularly if it aligns with the purpose piece that we talked about.
Yeah, I think when you talked about wanted to bring back to you, when you talked about awareness and you talked about mindfulness, and we talk about it all the time, and say, like, you know, doing that with awareness, just to drive home to listeners how important awareness is. So I'm listening to a podcast at the moment, and it's one of my favorite podcast hosts, which is the Model Health Show. And so I'm listening to an interview that he's doing with someone I first looked at their work maybe 12, 15 years ago. She's been in positive psychology movement for about 45 years, has done tons and tons of studies. A lady by the name of Ellen Langer. I'm not sure if you've heard of her or not. But anyway, I've used her studies many times in talks. And one of the things that she was talking about today and reminded me today of the study I was looking at was the hotel maid study. In fact, I did a video about this back in 2012, I think it was, on my early YouTube channel, where they took a group of hotel maids, right? People that change the bed, do the cleaning, all that. And they were from 7 different hotels across the state or wherever they were looking. And they had some people who said that they did no exercise. The rest said they did moderate exercise. And what they did is they did an 8 or 12 week study, and some of the group, maybe half the group, were, you know, just given a lecture on the importance of exercise, healthy lifestyle, and so on. And the other half were also told that, but then they were also told how when they hoover a room, it uses up 50 calories. When they do change the bed, it's 50 calories. Go up and down the stairs, it's 50, whatever the thing was. And then they came back 8 weeks later, 12 weeks later, and they checked they hadn't had any extra shift patterns, they hadn't changed their exercise habits, anything like that. And what happened was the group who were aware of what they were doing was actually exercise by multiple measures, whether it's BMI, hip to waist ratio, weight, all of that, had gone in the positive direction. Whereas the group that weren't aware that it was exercise, even though they were doing the same thing effectively, had no change. The other interesting thing, just how aware your mind is, right? So, for example, they did another study where they created a puncture wound in people, just a small one, because ethically they wouldn't be able to, like, probably cut the person. And then they were told how long something like that would typically take to heal. And those people that were told, like, the shorter amount of time, like it would take, you know, 15 minutes or an hour, whatever the thing was, collectively, statistically, had shorter healing times than those that were told it was longer. And she went on and on about these different studies. And the other one, I think it's Ellen Langer that did this one. I think you know this one, but they took, I think it was old age people, right? Geriatrics of some description in the 19, this is done in the 1970s, this study. And they took them to a disused army base, that was still set up as if it was the 1950s. And what they did is they had two groups of people. I think one were living in there and the other group was still living there, but they were told to act as if it was 20 years ago. So all the conversations they were having, all the magazines, everything was supposed to be as if it was 20 years earlier. When they looked at the study afterwards, they noticed that strength had increased in those people. They had better gait, as in walking. They were more upright with their posture. Their balance improved. They'd effectively regressed somewhat age-wise because they were told to carry their own luggage, all of this, and they became younger because of it, effectively. And this is just how powerful awareness in the mind is in your practice.
I think I'm seeing it right now with my dad, right? He's gone to France. The uncertainty of where he's going to be and how he was going to fare. Actually, when he's in France at his place, where he's got a nice big garden and things to do and he can get back to what he loves doing, he's not thinking about the illness or the cancer. When you're sat at home and you can't get out and you can't go anywhere, you're left with just your own thoughts. Of course, you take it to the worst place, the uncertainty. What, you know, when's it going to be my time? Will my family be with me? You know, will I get to see X? Will I make it to this birthday or not? And yet the idea of distraction now, he's in France. I'm not saying that this necessarily changes the end date, whoever the greater things out in the universe are dictating that time will be, is going to necessarily change. But his fear of it changes because he's not thinking about it all the time. I thought it was quite interesting when you talked about the weight one, though, because arguably you could say that those that are more aware of what calories they're burning actually put on more weight. Because when you have awareness about how much the calories, and actually you didn't give the result away, but I made the assumption they were losing. But often when you think you've lost or you've burnt so many calories, you give yourself more justification to go and any excess calories. So it'd be interesting if some of the results fluctuated one way or the other.
Although there was another study she was quoting where they had groups of people drinking a 350 calorie drink, and some group, a third of the group were told it was only 150 calories. Another group was told it was 350, and another group was told it was like 550. And the changes physiologically when they measured, whether it was blood glucose, all of these things, was totally different, right? Based on what they perceived they were having.
So I'm not reading, I haven't listened to that podcast. I will, it'll be on my, it's probably downloaded on my iPhone. I need to give it a listen. But what I will say, I've been reading the book Cured. And this is all about remarkable recoveries from, you know, terminal illnesses across the board. I'm reading it obviously because of my dad, and I think it's interesting, and the power of the mind is very much in there. But there are a lot of examples in there about where, you know, certain people have been given a placebo, but have been, because they didn't know they were given a placebo, were fully believed they had the actual medication. They've completely recovered from things that were completely terminal, just because the power of the mind, that they were certain in their mind that they were having something that was going to cure them. That's what they were told. They believed it. And lo and behold, they end up, you know, recovering from things that were in the world of Western medicine, shall we say, were unrecoverable from. And I think there's, you know, there's countless stories of that happening all over as well. How the mind is so strong.
I'll have to read that book, actually. I've read one similar, and I think you've read it as well, haven't you? Not Mind Over Medicine? I thought you'd read that one as well. Have you not?
Yeah, Mind Over Medicine, yeah. Yeah, it was a while ago, but yeah, it's really good. But I think some of this links, sorry to jump in, but I think this links back to the Nietzsche piece, right? He has a why to live by, bear almost anyhow, in the sense that how many examples out there when we talk about, and I know I don't want to be dark all the time or morbid because we talked a lot about death for obvious reasons with your dad and my dad at the moment, but how many people actually hold on for certain things? When you've got something to live by, you can defeat the uncertainty in many things or you know, prognosis that people have given because you need to get to a certain date or you need to get to a certain thing. But why does that happen? Because they've got a purpose. If you've got a really strong purpose and a really strong how, now, you know, I'm not saying it happens in every single case, but certainly there's a lot of evidence of people that have been able to live longer when they've got a purpose to live by. And on the opposite side of the coin, of course, when someone has a broken heart because a partner passes away before they do, or a child or whatever, but certainly there's a lot of examples in people that have been together for their entire lives that when one passes away, the other tends to, and often they say they died of a broken heart. That's because the purpose is gone, the why is gone, and you know, the body can react in a completely different way altogether. God, I didn't mean to take that to such a morbid place after such a positive start.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. I mean, it goes wherever it goes. I mean, but, you know, going back to your placebo examples, this is a surely a level of certainty there, because you're given this pill and you're certain to some degree, right? Because you're told, okay, this is a new drug. It's working wonders in people, blah, blah, blah. So you've got that certainty from the doctor that this is going to help you in some way, even though it was a placebo. And therefore you create that certainty in your mind and therefore body, and it becomes a reality. And most drugs actually that are tested, which are tested against placebo, and placebo works anywhere from, they say on average 30%, but in reality it's anywhere from 10 to maybe 80% of the time, effectively, or just as, in fact, someone set up a company selling placebo pills. They actually did quite well. They said to people they were actually placebos, but you can buy them, you can use them for headaches, whatever. And they did well. And so I think it's to do with that level of certainty, because you're certain that this thing is going to help you. And most doctors, I think, who treat people will say, a lot of the time it's the body that's doing the healing itself, right? They're giving these medications to allow that to happen a lot of the time. But I wonder, and I strongly suspect we've got no idea how much the body is actually influencing that healing rather than the exogenous thing that you're putting in. And I think a lot of that is coming from a certainty that it will work. It's very interesting, this concept, I think, of being certain something is going to work, and therefore it does work. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because you believe it's so strong. And this is how witch doctors always got away with doing the things they did, right? Because there's so much belief in that person that if they put a hex on you or they did this, then you might, you know, pass away or whatever a hex is.
I mean, there's entire industries based on superstition, right? So whether you, but not, I'm not here to dispel or deny anything superstitions for those that have them, but there are entire things based on superstition where, you know, if you believe something enough, you believe it'll be true, you'll avoid it. I mean, to be honest, I don't think I've stepped on three drains for about 20 years. I don't even know where that started from. I know it's completely ridiculous, yet something in the back of my mind goes, yeah, I think I'll just avoid those three drones. I don't want any bad luck. And I don't even really believe in luck as a concept. So that makes absolutely no sense.
We are weird creatures. Like when a colleague of mine used to do that as well, and always avoid those three drains. And then sometimes I'll walk over and I'll go, damn it, I shouldn't have done that, because, you know, Richard would not approve, and it puts me off now as well. And I'm like, please watch this thing, Nick, actually. It was years ago, but Derren Brown, I think it was Derren Brown. You know Derren Brown. Did you watch the special he did about luck? I'm not sure what it's called. I'll have to look it up.
I think I've watched everything he's done and pretty much read everything he's done as well. So yeah.
And it was, for example, and this happened to me afterwards. So those people that thought they were luckier tended to have better luck. So they did. He did one experiment where he would put like a £10 note on the floor and did people pick it up or not? And those that were lucky, yeah. And I remember a week after I watched that, I found a £10 note on the floor when I was walking, and then I gave it to someone who needed it. But that episode on luck was really, really interesting, because he created that lucky town, didn't he, where there was that lucky pole, and they and it was all about whether luck is engineered or not. I think what's the phrase? It was from a golfer, right? The harder I work, the luckier I get. I think it was like Jack Nichols or something like that. And I think that's so true. Or luck is where opportunity or preparation meets opportunity. And I think that's so true, because, for example, if you go, like, for example, you're a classic example of this, right? You work incredibly hard, right? You've got these three podcasts. You're having conversations with hundreds of people a year on the podcast alone. And you go to all these networking events. You do all these things. Yes, opportunities will eventually come, because you're putting yourself in those environments where that's going to happen. Whereas if you're not doing anything, you go, well, why is my business not just suddenly taking off? Why is Nick so lucky and I'm not? Well, Nick is lucky because he spends 15 hours a week on podcasts, and he does this. So he's had that preparation. And then when the opportunity comes, which is maybe one out of every 50 things that he does, because he's done those 50 things in 50 days instead of 6 years, he's going to get luckier quicker.
I couldn't agree more. You know, that's the idea of you create your own luck, which is a kind of a contradiction in terms in that instance. But it's the idea of buying a lottery ticket, right? So if you win, you're not necessarily lucky. You're prepared for opportunity. You're prepared by buying it in the first place. That was the preparation piece. And the opportunity is the result. that's just, you know, it's statistics. That, yeah, if you've got it, fine, but you're still prepared for the opportunity. I can't physically win because I don't do the lottery. There is literally no chance I'm going to win the lottery. So it's, you know, those that do win, even though they only spent a pound doing it, they still prepared themselves for the opportunity.
In it to win it, as they say. You've got to be in it to win it. Or Wayne Gretzky, right, the ice hockey player, one of my favourite quotes, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Yeah, love that. Very good. As a sporting fan, I was like, oh, it's not a bad place to probably round all the time he's done. About an hour already. God, we've been rabbiting on. Hopefully, for those that are struggling with anything from uncertainty, I'll let you sign off today for the listeners. I'll finish with this bit and I'll hand back to you, Harry. But there's a movie which I've talked about on the show before. I love it. It changed my life, and in a way that people won't realize, but it's massive. And I say it to everyone that I meet since, certainly in the coaching capacity of my kids. About a Zoo. Brilliant movie. It's about a zoo actually based just around the corner. You know where I'm going with this. Just around the corner for me here in Devon. American movie, but the zoo itself was based in Devon. But it starts with Matt Damon meeting his wife, and he's scared to go and say hello. And he says, you know what? 20 seconds of courage, 20 seconds of bravery. Just, you can do anything for 20 seconds. Just be brave for 20 seconds and then see what opportunities come on the back of it. Now, he was uncertain when he went into that. And it's based on a true story, right? So when he went into that cafe and asked his wife for her number, or, you know, whatever it was he said, or made that introduction, he didn't know at that point he was going to become his wife, but he was uncertain that she could have just said, I'm married, or no, I'm not interested, or whatever. And there's so many examples of this happening in the real world. But he took that 20 seconds of bravery to walk into that place and meet her. And unfortunately, I won't give the film away. It's quite sad in terms of what happens, but he ends up buying the zoo. But it's all based on that 20 seconds of courage. So if you are feeling uncertain, when you get going, when you get into that flow, whether it's getting up on stage, doing that public talk, doing that thing that you're unsure about, after about 20 seconds, you'll find a lot of that initial anxiety is gone. You'll be in a different state than you were 20 seconds ago, whatever that state is. Hopefully it's somewhere better. But the position, the state of mind, everything that you, the whole way you saw the world before that moment of stress, that moment of uncertainty, 20 seconds later will look entirely different. And then you'll deal with what's in front of you at that moment. But take 20 seconds. Just go, you know what? I can do it for 20 seconds. I can go into that room. I can have that meeting with my manager. I can go and talk on that stage. I can do that stand-up gig. I can jump out, you know, 20 seconds. When you're doing a skydive like me, I had to be brave for 20 seconds. That was the time it took me to look out, hold my breath, shut my eyes and let go. And I'm out. It's not, you know, I'm done. 20 seconds. But you needed to be brave for 20 seconds to make that happen. So that's the bit I'll leave the listeners with.
I love that. I'm sure we've talked about it before, because I remember seeing that clip of that movie about a week before I met a previous girlfriend, where I was afraid to go up to her and speak to her. And then that movie popped into my head. And I thought, I've only got to be brave for 20 seconds. And I did. And I literally thought that as I was going up to her. I go, it's only a 20 second walk to her. And then we ended up being together for years after that. But had I not watched that movie and thought about that, I might not have done that. And I think what I would leave the listeners with is somewhat similar, where what I was saying before, which is two things. One, find certainty within yourself in the uncertain times. But more importantly, build uncertainty into your life in those 20-second moments, in those small moments, whether it is chatting to the person, whether it is ordering a different cup of coffee, it's taking a different walk to work. Build uncertainty into your life so that when those proper uncertain moments come, which you can't orchestrate, you have got certainty that you can adapt, because you've already got the certainty. Oh, I chose that different cup of coffee. It wasn't that bad. Sometimes I tell people to put their trouser leg on the other way, right? Because often people have a favored leg, like left leg or right leg. And we do the certain way all the time. And then just use the other trouser leg, your other leg first, because what it will do is it will tell your brain, oh, I did something that was unpredictable, uncertain, and I'm okay. I'm still alive. And then you build that into your psychology, where you say, I'm actually okay with uncertainty. That is the best advice I would give to people, is build it into your daily habits, moments of uncertainty, because then when the real uncertainty comes, you're going to be certain that you can adapt and you can flex and move in the way that you need to. So that's what I would leave people with. And what now, I'm certain it's time for us to close off and get on with the rest of our evening and see what the week brings us, I think.
Oh yeah, I'm going to mention as well, we've got, we are launching our YouTube channel. So Mindful Past YouTube channel. So hopefully you're watching this on that platform. If you're not, do go and subscribe. Please do subscribe to us as well on your favorite podcast channel, wherever that might be. Leave us a review if you can, be hugely grateful. But most importantly for us, if you can spread the word, share the show, whether it's on YouTube, whether it's on your podcast platform, whatever it might be, with anyone you think might benefit from the content we're producing, that would be hugely, hugely appreciated for myself and Harry. Harry, thanks ever so much for today, mate. It's been a pleasure to catch up as always.
Likewise, Nick. And thank you, listeners, for your continued support. And please, yeah, think of one or two people who you feel could benefit from listening to this show and share it directly with them via WhatsApp or anywhere else you share things with.
Nice stuff.
All right. Take care.
Stay healthy.